demonstrations. Obviously, the right to protest basically doesn't exist anymore here in Mexico City, nor does the right of personal integrity. The internet is full of videos of police assaulting protesters and people who were nearby the protests. Freedom of expression is at risk.
A new report from Amnesty International says Peña Nieto has failed to curb rampant human rights abuses in Mexico, including forced disappearances, arbitrary detentions, and torture. A Florida woman whose case has drawn national attention over alleged racial bias has been freed on bail pending her upcoming trial. Marissa Alexander, an African-American mother of three, was sentenced to 20 years in prison for firing a warning shot at a wall near her abusive husband. Alexander's sentence drew comparisons to George Zimmerman's acquittal for the killing of Trayvon Martin. A Florida appeals court ordered a new trial earlier this year, saying the jury for her case received faulty instructions. On Wednesday night, the eve of Thanksgiving, Alexander was released on more than $200,000 bond. She'll remain under house arrest until her new trial begins in March. The Republican National Committee drew mockery on Sunday when its Twitter account posted a picture of Rosa Parks with the message, "Today we remember Rosa Parks' bold stand and her role in ending racism." The RNC later tweeted a correction saying it meant to honor Parks for her role in fighting to end racism. But the original tweet led thousands to post messages using the satirical hashtag, "Racism ended when." The last jailed member of the Greenpeace Arctic 30 has been granted bail in Russia after over 2 months behind bars. Australian activist Colin Russell was the only one to remain jailed after the 29 others were granted bail late last March. All 30 face up to 7 years in prison for the boarding of a Russian oil platform to stop oil drilling in the Arctic. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News after these messages.
Responding to listener and community requests, we are engaging in a trial period of broadcasting the Tom Hartman Show from 4 to 5 p.m. each weekday. We take seriously the feedback we have received from listeners, non-listeners, KBOO members, and volunteers. This trial period is both an attempt to present the program, which is currently unavailable on broadcast media in the Portland area, and to solicit feedback on how appropriate this program is for KBOO. Please call 503-231-8032 or write to program@kboo.org with your opinion.
At KBOO, we have a dynamic community of 500 volunteers doing everything from front desk work, janitorial work, community reporting, hosting information booths, clerical support, news writing, documentary making, engineering live music, operating soundboards, working in the music library, and many, many other things. KBOO absolutely depends on volunteers to carry out the work of the station. We are always looking for new volunteers. We have monthly volunteer orientations, which is the first step in getting involved. Contact KBOO Volunteer Coordinator Annie Haynes about the next volunteer orientation at 503-231-8032 extension 231 or at volunteer@kboo.org.
KBOO is seeking a station manager to lead our dynamic 45-year-old non-commercial radio station. Ideal candidates will have nonprofit management experience, the ability to thrive and work collaboratively in a decentralized organization, and the ability to delegate, plan, and organize people to meet goals and objectives. If this interests you, please go to kboo.fm/stationmanagerhire2013.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor a salsa dance party to celebrate 17 years of the Community Alliance of Tenants, the only statewide grassroots tenants rights organization. December 6th from 6:30 to 9:30 p.m., this party will include a light dinner buffet, short program, and salsa lesson. It will take place at the Grand Cafe at 832 Southeast Grand Avenue in Portland, Oregon. Again, that's the Community Alliance of Tenants, Salsa Party December 6th from 6:30 to 9:30 p.m. at the Grand Cafe. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 19th year of the Portland Revels. The Portland Revels will perform 11 shows between December 6th and December 15th. That's the Portland Revels, December 6th to the 15th at the Scottish Rite Center in downtown Portland. More information about the show can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Every Monday night at 8 o'clock, you can hear this voice alerting you that
you are about to cross the border.
And then follow the footsteps to a two-hour-long sustained environment of uninterrupted sonic art or new electronic, experimental, or postmodern music. Audio that breaks and rewrites the rules to create entirely new worlds of sound. Where will you be on Mondays at 8 when the door slams shut? Here on KBOO Portland.
KBOO is proud to present one of the greatest jazz films ever made, Round Midnight. Join us Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater for this 1986 American-French film that captured the Paris jazz scene of the 1950s. Watch jazz legend Dexter Gordon deliver an Oscar-nominated performance. Round Midnight, the Clinton Street Theater, Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m., 2522 Southeast Clinton.
In conjunction with KBOO's presentation of Round Midnight at the Clinton Street Theater, tune in Wednesday afternoon, December 11th, when KBOO jazz host Rita Rega talks with bassist Chuck Israels about his experiences in the Paris jazz scene in the 1950s, playing with pianist Bud Powell, the real-life inspiration for the film. That's Wednesday afternoon, December 11th, between noon and 2 p.m. on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, climate activists protesting the megaloads tar sands have blockaded and successfully stopped the shipments of equipment east.
Residents in Malvinas, Argentina protest against biotech giant Monsanto against a plant being built next to a local school.
And we have an update from Joe Meyer on the Mohamed Mohamud terrorism trial sentencing phase suspension. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, December 2nd, 2013. I'm Ross Freeman Levin.
And I'm John Rasmussen. Climate activists blocked a controversial shipment last night, forcing contractors to reschedule the megaload's departure from the port of Umatilla in Oregon. The equipment, a 900,000-pound water purifier, 22 feet wide, 18 feet tall, and 376 feet in length, was met by a diverse group of regional activists. This week's protest was larger than a similar protest last week, as news of the shipment has spread throughout the region. Similar loads sparked major protests moving throughout Idaho and Montana, including a blockade by the Nez Perce tribe in August. KBOO reporter Ross Freeman Levin spoke with Michael Gaskill from the group Rising Tide, who was at the protest.
Michael, can you describe the action that happened last night and what the outcome was?
Last night was the first night that they were actually scheduled to roll on Oregon highways. So members of Portland Rising Tide, Wild Idaho Rising Tide, members of the Umatilla tribe, as well as other regional activists, came together. I would say about 60 regional climate activists, along with, I would say, a dozen to 20 tribal members. The evening started with a ceremony from the Umatilla, and one of their elders, said a few inspiring words. They led a prayer ceremonial chant after that. There was a lot of, you know, the usual chanting and getting people pumped up. Then when they were getting ready to get that behemoth rolling, several dozen of us just walked right through the barrier. And while that was happening, on the other side of the truck, a couple individuals locked themselves to a couple different parts of the truck, one underneath the front axle of the lead truck. And from then, it took the police a few hours to get them out of those lockboxes, which, if listeners don't know, a lockbox is, in this instance, a metal device which people put their arms into, which and it is a way to kind of lock onto a device or say, a car axle without damaging any property, and it's extremely difficult to get someone out of there. By the time the cops were able to extract the two folks that locked down, it was too late for the megaloads to roll. See, they only have between 8 p.m. and 6 in the morning to move this on these windy back highways. We kept them at bay long enough last night that they weren't able to roll at all, which this is the first time that a megaload has been stopped for an entire night by activists.
So far, how many megaloads have gone on this route on their way to the tar sands?
This is the first load, the one that we're here in Umatilla blocking, that would go on this particular route. See, what's going on is there is these giant pieces of critical equipment being manufactured in Vancouver, B.C., and due to various reasons, they're not able to just move it across Canada. And we like to think it's because of the amazing opposition to all kinds of fossil fuel infrastructure projects that First Nations folks up there have been struggling against. So they've been shipping it up the Columbia. Right now, there are three megaloads, three 900,000-pound pieces of equipment sitting in the port of Umatilla. This one that we successfully blocked last night is just the first of three scheduled loads to go out between now and January. And we don't want any of them to go out. And we need people to mobilize. And you can do that by going onto PortlandRisingTide.org. We're trying to help by making ourselves, like a rideshare hub, and we've been doing that for this. Our Facebook, you can also click on some links off of our Facebook. And learning about all of these issues, you can also go to our website. Actually, Earth First Newswire is a really excellent source of breaking news on struggles all over. And I just want to really make clear, you know, this is not about us not wanting tar sands equipment in our backyard. We don't want it in anybody's backyard. And this is not just a struggle of Portland activists. We're standing in solidarity with people in Umatilla. We're standing in solidarity with the people of the tar sands area and the Elsa Pogtog of New Brunswick, who have called for and have gotten a massive series of blockades all over in solidarity with their blockade of fracking up in New Brunswick, Canada. So I just want to make clear that this is our little part of a much larger struggle.
Thank you, Michael, for your time.
Thank you.
This has been Ross Freeman Levin with KBOO News.
An activist at the megaload blockade recorded people locked down to the tar sands refining equipment before their arrest. These are their voices.
Can you state your name and then spell it, sir?
Sure. My name is Leonard Higgins. Leonard is L-E-O-N-A-R-D, Higgins, H-I-G-G-I-N-S.
Okay, and where are you from?
I'm from Corvallis, Oregon. I was born in Oregon. I've lived here all my life.
And can you just describe real quick what this ornamentation you have on your hands is and where you're at?
I'm told it's a lockbox. I'm locked to the truck and I can't get loose now.
Okay. And can you just tell me why you've decided to lock yourself to this giant piece of machinery?
I'm doing it for my children and my grandchildren. The tar sands oil is a climate bomb. It's going to ruin the life support systems that we all rely on.
And so you've decided to take direct action, it sounds like. and put your own body on the line?
I have. I don't see our leaders doing anything about the problem. I don't even see the problem being acknowledged.
Right. And I'm just anything else you might wanna say to folks out here?
I'm real proud of all the people that have come out in the cold to stop this. In addition to climate change, this isn't good for Oregon either. There's wilderness that the trucks are going to be going through, and it's just not right. It's not right for Oregon. It's not right for the planet.
Okay. And how long do you plan on staying here?
I'm here for the duration.
Do you know if they'll be able to get you out of there?
I'm not sure. I'm prepared to be here all night and several days if needed.
Can you just describe for me in as little or as much detail as you feel like, can you describe this lockbox that you have your arms in?
So my arms are in cased in steel and fastened by the wrist, and I'm locked to part of the truck.
Yeah, it looks like it's wrapped in foam. It looks like a steel. It looks kind of like L-shaped, and it looks like you've locked yourself around part of the cab of the truck.
Yes, that's right.
Right now I'm talking with a fellow who is sitting underneath the gigantic front axle of this truck that is scheduled to start hauling the megaloads. Can you give your name and spell it?
Sure. My name is Scott Schroeder, Scott Schroeder.
Can you just kind of describe for folks listening, just describe your situation, the device that you have yourself locked to, and where you're at right now exactly in your own words?
Sure. So I have to confess that I don't totally understand my situation that well, but I appear to be underneath some monstrous machine of some kind, and I'm definitely locked to an axle. My hands are encased in a metal tube, and it feels pretty impermeable, and like I'm sort of truly bonded to the truck at the moment, which would imply that if the truck were to move, it would probably injure me gravely or kill me. So hopefully they're not willing to do that, to move the truck, although they're willing to sort of doom humanity and the planet. So I guess we'll have to see.
Hey, brother.
And
giving you love, brother.
And
giving you love.
Can you tell me why you've decided to take direct action in this way and lock yourself to the axle of this truck?
Well, sure. I think that it's manifestly clear that sort of the political process as it exists right now is doing absolutely nothing to address climate change at the scale and the rate it's occurring. And so, as far as I can tell, the world economic system and the world political system are truly willing to doom the planet to a sort of unspeakable apocalypse, and the only solution that I can see is mass mobilization against fossil fuel extraction and infrastructure.
And do you see yourself and the action you've taken today as part of a broader movement?
Yeah, I see this as an action in the global context of resistance to fossil fuels.
I'm a journalist with KBOO. That's fine. You need
anything else you want
to
say?
No, I'm good. Solidarity with Native folks. No tar sands.
Go. We gave you time. Back up.
Those were the voices of activists at the Megalo blockade, with people locked down to the tar sands refining equipment before their arrest.
The Justice Department filed a memo last Tuesday, which once again has delayed the sentencing in the so-called Christmas tree bombing trial of Mohamed Mohamud. For more, KBOO's Joe Meyer spoke with Tun Ying, law professor at Lewis and Clark University.
Since the trial, there's been a series of postponements.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Typically after conviction, sentencing would take place 2 or 3 months later, and that's to give the probation officer time to write up the probation report or the pre-sentence report, give that to the parties, the government and the defendant. They can make their objections, and then the judge would read the papers and then sentence. And so this sentencing has been postponed for a long time now, since he was convicted at the end of January. So I was wondering at first if there was some kind of post-conviction cooperation agreement that they were trying to work out, which is not very common. Usually you'd see cooperation agreements occur before trial and typically resulting in a plea deal, a plea bargain of some sort. But now with the latest revelation that, you know, the government has indicated that there was a lot of FISA-related material, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act material that it used, and now the defense is, it seems like, mounting some kind of challenge, which I understand is under seal with the court, but they're trying to get more discovery. It may be that the government simply used what it thought was inculpatory, that is, the evidence from FISA that made Mohammed look guilty is what they introduced. And the defense has been fighting a lot about getting exculpatory material from the government. So that is part of the discovery motions, I think. But you also have to wonder if they're making a full-scale challenge to the constitutionality of FISA itself. That is to say, it's not just that you didn't give us evidence that you're supposed to give us, but in fact, you never should have been able to get this evidence into trial in the first place because FISA is, we think, is unconstitutional. Now, defendants have made that argument before, and they've lost because FISA has been upheld in this context. But that was before the Edward Snowden disclosures, and so, you know, maybe the time is ripe now to revisit the issue.
These delays have been happening for some months now, and there's some new revelation last Tuesday with a Justice Department memo.
Right. So, and that's, I think, what's playing into this order that the judge issued, where he postponed the sentencing, and there's that line that, you know, I'll rule on this, and if sentencing is still warranted, then sentencing will take place early next year.
In that Justice Department memo, they didn't say they broke any laws. They said that they followed the laws. And so what's the sticking point there?
Well, so the issue is the Fourth Amendment says, in very general terms, that all persons have no unreasonable searches or seizures shall take place except upon issuance of a warrant, blah, 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 blah. So the idea is that, in general, before you or I or any person in the country is searched by the government needs to have a warrant backed up by probable cause. So that's the general default. Now, it turns out there are a lot of exceptions to the warrant requirement that have developed, and it basically takes an entire semester of criminal procedure to go through it here at the law school. FISA is a little bit different. For the FISA warrant, it's not probable cause that the person has committed a crime, which is your normal sort of law enforcement search warrant. FISA is about gathering foreign intelligence information. So the standard is probable cause to believe that the target is an agent of a foreign power. And so the tricky thing that comes up is, if what we're doing is we're spying on foreign governments and their agents so that our government can be more effective in foreign policy, there's no criminal implications. That's what FISA is most clearly about. What becomes tricky is, what happens if, while we're spying in this way, that we find out that somebody's committing a crime? Can the intelligence people who got the FISA warrant for spying purposes turn over evidence of criminal activity to law enforcement officials for prosecution purposes? That's what FISA is about. And pre-9/11, the Justice Department had interpreted FISA to make it very difficult to do this kind of information sharing. And then after 9/11 happened, and after the 9/11 Commission determined that one of the reasons that we didn't stop the plot was intelligence sharing failures, that is, the CIA knew about some of the 9/11 hijackers, and so did FBI intelligence analysts, but they didn't tell FBI law enforcement side people because of the wall. there was a lot of impetus to lower the wall, so to speak, to make it easier to share information. So in that sense, the government is right in saying that what they've done is comply with FISA as it's been interpreted. But what I gather the defense may be arguing in this case is to say that's not good enough, that that interpretation of FISA to allow information sharing violates the Fourth Amendment.
Where does this Justice Department meld us? What's likely, a retrial or throw it out? Or,
you know, since a lot of this is under seal, it's hard to know. My guess is that it probably won't lead to a new trial and that the whole thing will go up to the Ninth Circuit on appeal. So it'll be one of the issues for the appellate court to resolve, along with whether the defense should have gotten to question the undercover informants or agents much more about their background and identities, which they were not allowed to do. I think that would be another of the key issues on appeal. And then the last one, I think, is whether the government needed to show that Mr. Muhammad was predisposed to commit the exact kind of crime that is not just to kill a lot of people, but to do it with a bomb, a car bomb, at Pioneer Square.
Right. And does that appeal typically happen after sentencing?
Yes. So after sentencing, the defendant would have 10 days to file a notice of appeal. And that's not the briefing itself. It's just simply that you intend to appeal, and then the Ninth Circuit would set a briefing schedule for when the briefs are due.
Well, what could the judge have meant then by if sentencing is still appropriate?
Well, I think what that means is that if, based on the rule, the motions that the defense is filing now, the trial judge decides that, in fact, he is going to grant a new trial, then sentencing would not be appropriate. Then he would have a new trial.
Okay. Anything else for our listeners, Professor?
No. I mean, I think this case, you know, it continues to go on and on because of the defense is really putting in a lot of time and resources into it. You know, it's obviously, I think, in some ways a bellwether case for much of the country because most of these cases plead out. And, you know, this is one that actually went to trial and went to trial with a very vigorous defense on the entrapment issue.
That was KBOO's Joe Meyer speaking with Tun Yin, law professor at Lewis and Clark University.
Last Friday, a Portland Walmart store was the scene for demonstrations concerning better wages and working conditions. Around 200 people marched around the store to publicize the plight of Walmart workers, while the company reaps $17 billion in annual profits. Motorists on 82nd Street honked in support of the marchers while they chanted, "Hey, hey, ho, ho, corporate greed has got to go," during the Black Friday protest. Workers and labor advocates are seeking a minimum wage of $13 per hour, more full-time work, and an end to illegal retaliation against employees who have sought to unionize the stores around the country. Last week, the National Labor Relations Board decided to prosecute Walmart for illegal firings and disciplinary actions involving more than 100 workers, including those who went on strike last June. City Commissioner Steve Novick spoke in support of the demonstration, saying he would put Walmart at the top of the list of companies the city should no longer invest in due to its notorious record of poor wages and working conditions.
It's Cyber Monday, the online shopping day that comes on the heels of Black Friday and, this year, Thanksgiving Thursday, when many stores also were open for business. Nonprofit groups are hoping for more caring and less consumerism for an observance tomorrow created by the year-old organization. For more on this story, here's KBOO reporter Genevieve McDaniel in collaboration with Oregon News Service.
Merchants report sales up 2.3% compared with last year in the holiday buying frenzy of Thanksgiving Thursday and Black Friday, and today is Cyber Monday, known for online shopping. So, charitable groups are hoping there's some time and money left for a different focus. Giving Tuesday is tomorrow, December 3rd. It began last year as an antidote to the holiday consumer frenzy and has grown to include more than 8,000 partner organizations in all 50 states. Henry Timms, who runs a New York Y, is credited with coming up with the idea.
every year we hear a lot of people complaining about they think things are too consumer focused. What we hope is that Giving Tuesday gives them a chance to really put that complaint to good use and think, how can I give something back?
The event is also known as hashtag Giving Tuesday since it started on social media. Retailers rely on the period between Thanksgiving and Christmas for a major portion of their annual sales, and last week's two-day total topped $12 billion. Giving Tuesday suggests a pause to consider sharing over shopping. Tim says this year they're putting an online spin on the fad of taking selfies, photos of themselves that people share on social media. He calls it the unselfie.
So the unselfie takes that idea and says, actually, share a picture of something more important. Share a picture of you doing something useful for others. Share a picture of a cause that matters deeply to you. Do something unselfish around Giving Tuesday.
This is Genevieve McDaniel with KBOO News.
Police cited a Minnesota man for disorderly conduct after he threw $1,001 bills over a railing at the Mall of America over the weekend. The man said that he wanted to spread holiday cheer and gain some good karma by throwing his last $1,000 over the upper floor railing while the choir below sang, "Let It Snow." His attempt to spread the holiday cheer came after a divorce from his wife and losing his business, and he hoped to have some positivity thrown his way. The mall has banned him from their premises for 1 year.
Parents, students, and teachers numbering in the dozens rallied in the North Clackamas School District on Saturday to prevent the closure of Concord Elementary School in Milwaukee, Oregon. Superintendent Matt Utterback recommended the closure in early November after a report evaluating all five Rex Putnam feeder schools determined Concord was the best candidate for closure due to anticipated costs between now and the year 2021. A public hearing for community members to voice their concerns is scheduled for Wednesday night this week at the Sabin Schellenberg Skills Center and for the school board to announce its final decision on the matter, which will come on December 12th. Utterback conveyed Concord's locale just off McLaughlin Boulevard makes it marketable property that could garner the district as much as $5 million if sold.
The Oregon Department of Education released their annual report card last week, showing a 2% rise in the student-to-teacher ratio. In Portland, the teachers' union and school board have declared impasse in contract negotiations, with class size one of the sticking points.
Founders of a publicly funded chain of charter schools settled today with the Oregon Department of Justice, promising to reimburse the Education Department for $475,000 of the near $20 million obtained in state and federal resources. Charges of seven different crimes, including racketeering and negligent misrepresentation, were brought against Tim King and Norm Donahue in January after a three-year-long investigation. State officials said they're satisfied with the agreement, contending that since King filed for bankruptcy in the year 2011, recovering a 40th of the total amount is acceptable. Both men agreed to be banned from involving themselves financially with charter schools for the rest of their lives, though King is already launching a new campus in Washington State.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Following this newscast at 5:45, Jimmy Tardy talks about sustainable civilization with Dave Gardner, producer of the documentary Growth Busters. Labor Radio is at 6 o'clock, followed by Prison Pipeline at 6:30. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio with news and views from a hip-hop perspective. There's a 50% chance of snow tonight, with lows around 30 degrees. Tomorrow's weather is sunny with a high of 68 degrees. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are as follows. 31 counts per minute in North Portland with highs of 65. Damascus has 33 counts per minute, highs of 52. Powell Butte is 25 counts per minute with highs of 44. Raleigh Hills is 29 counts per minute with highs of 47. Seaside, Oregon is 45 counts per minute, highs of 47. And Medford, Oregon is 37 counts per minute with highs of 57. EPA alert levels start at 100 counts per minute. More information can be found at ratcast.org.
It's 5:35. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Coca-Cola is running a stealth advertising campaign. Stealth? Why would a corporation as ad-dependent as Coke spend big bucks on advertising that it doesn't want consumers to notice? Shh. Because the campaign is a surreptitious ploy to enlist restaurants in a marketing conspiracy that targets you, your children, and, of course, your wallet. Coke calls its covert gambit Cap the Tap, urging restaurateurs to stop offering plain old tap water to customers. Quote, every time your business fills a cup or a glass with tap water, it pours potential profits down the drain. Cap the Tap can put a stop to that, says Coke, by teaching your crew members or wait staff suggestive selling techniques to convert requests for tap water into orders for revenue-generating beverages. The program provides a guide for restaurant managers who would direct Coke's customer assault, a backroom poster to remind waitstaff, quote, when and how to suggestively sell beverages, and a participant's guide to put suggestive selling foremost in the mind as staff confronts the enemy. Customers. Tactics include outflanking those recalcitrant customers who insist on water. Just switch the sales pitch to bottled water. Remember, Coca-Cola owns Dasani, one of the top-selling brands of bottled water in the U.S. Early in its Cap the Tap scheme, the beverage behemoth offered two incentive programs for waitstaff, Suggest More and Score, and Get Your Fill. Both were competitions to spur servers to push more Coke on American restaurant goers. This is Jim Hightower saying, Coke's CEO has declared that, quote, obesity is today's most challenging health issue, and solving it requires all of us doing our part. Really? By selling more Coke? That's proof that hypocrisy is now the official rocket fuel of corporate profits.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
The campaign to help save the bees is trying to get certain pesticides, such as neonicotinoids, banned from use by the EPA. The campaign was launched today in order to coincide with the European Union's two-year prohibition of three of the most dangerous neonicotinoids. For more on the importance of bees and what's happening to them, KBOO News reporter Genevieve McDaniel spoke with Paul Anderson from the Portland, Oregon State Beekeepers Association.
What is your organization?
My name is Paul Anderson, and the organization that I'm with is the Oregon State Beekeepers Association. We are an organization of both commercial beekeepers, what we refer to as sideline beekeepers, people who would be doing beekeeping and maybe at the sideline to another position not related to beekeeping, and the hobbyist beekeepers in the state of Oregon.
Why are bees important?
Well, the bees are important for mainly the pollinization of large food crops, commercial food crops, and they're also important for just the general pollinization of plants in any type of an environment, whether it be the city, suburban, or rural.
What is happening to the bees?
Well, what is happening to the bees is really something that isn't totally clear. There are a lot of factors that are impacting bees nowadays. There's a number of pests that are bothering them. One is the primary one is called the Varroa mite, which lives on the bee and lives off the blood, the hemolymph of the bee. And they also spread viral diseases to the bees. Another thing is the environment of a bee living off of a monoculture for extended periods of time. And by that, we mean that the bees go into a commercial field of, say, blackberries. And they just live off of that blackberry pollen and nectar for an extended period of time. They don't get a diversified diet. And the third thing is, and what seems to be getting the most press is the pesticides that the bees are exposed to. Neonicotinoids happens to be one of the ones that seems to be one of the pesticides of primary concern at this point in time. However, it's a situation where, you know, the beekeepers have to use pesticides themselves in order to control the mites. in some of those issues. So the beekeepers aren't necessarily against the use of pesticides, but one of the things that we feel is very important is that pesticides get used according to the label. A large cause of bee die-off is the misuse of pesticides. And that was shown as a great example was the event that took place in Wilsonville last summer, where the Target parking lot had been sprayed for aphids at the wrong time of day, and actually while the trees were blooming, which is not the proper use of that type of pesticide. And that was a neonicotinoid pesticide that they used for that.
How can we reduce the use of neonicotinoids and use it more responsibly?
At this point in time, we can't really say that neonicotinoids are a single cause. They're one of many causes that are impacting bees, and it's a combination of these that is more than likely the main problem that the bees are having. And, if you're using them responsibly, according to the label, it's going to have much less of an impact on all aspects of the environment, not just bees, but all aspects.
Why should Oregonians care about the bees?
Well, bees supply, or are involved in the supply, of about one out of every three bites of food that people eat. Bees are extremely important to the agricultural industry, both in Oregon and other states, and they're very important to our food supply. They give us a diversified food supply where we have things like almonds out of California. We've got lots of apples and cherries and pears and peaches coming out of Oregon, and a lot of those are very dependent upon the bees. The yields of those fields or orchards increase significantly when bees are involved in pollination.
I have been speaking with Paul Anderson from the Oregon State Beekeepers Association. This is Genevieve McDaniel with KBOO News.
In Malvinas, Argentina today, protesters blocked the entry to a seed plant being built by biotech giant Monsanto. Local media is accusing the groups of being environmentalists with political ties, though locals on the ground claim they are largely made up of mothers who fear for their children's safety. Monsanto has over 2 trillion acres of transgenic crops growing in 12 provinces across Argentina. The locals had begrudgingly put up with pesticide use until they learned of a plant being built next to a school plot in Malvinas. Both Argentina and Brazil are known for their lack of monitoring the effects on their citizens' health caused by Monsanto's trademark pesticides. Doctors report a rise in cancer and birth defects, while locals have seen their children suffering from nosebleeds and respiratory problems. The National Science and Technical Research Council, CONCEIT, found 87% of the residents would like a vote in the plant being built. The council also recorded that 58% of the residents currently oppose the factory outright.
And now we go to the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. L&M Hospital in Connecticut locked out 790 nurses and healthcare techs represented by AFT Healthcare Locals 5049 and 5051 over the weekend. The lockout happened after the first strike in the hospital's 101-year history. The nurses were locked out when they tried to return to work. Defiant nurses rallied over the weekend as they took a strong stand to preserve access to quality patient care. Lisa Diabrosca was one of them.
We all made history. For the first time in a very, very long time, we stood up and we empowered ourselves. And we said to that corporation that runs that hospital, we said, no, you are not going to continue to step all over us and our patients.
Stephanie Johnson is a sleep lab tech at L&M.
I am so proud of every single one of both of our membership for standing up and telling Bruce Cummings and his merry men that we are not going to take their crap anymore.
Connecticut State Senator Catherine Osten supports the nurses in their effort to win a fair new contract that's also good for healthcare workers and for patients.
For years, the middle class has given back, for years, and corporate profits in this not-for-profit hospital have gone up. No longer will we stand by and allow your jobs to be given away, your wages to be given away, successful, and we have to struggle. We are done giving back.
Walmart's new CEO shows no signs of raising wages or respecting Walmart workers' rights to organize unions without company retaliation. At least 110 workers and their supporters were arrested during peaceful civil disobedience and 1,500 Black Friday protests and strikes nationwide. Our Walmart says tens of thousands of people supported Walmart workers in these national Black Friday actions, demanding that the world's largest retailer use some of its roughly $17 billion per year in profit to pay living wages to Walmart workers. Seven Democratic members of Congress publicly backed the Walmart workers' struggle. U.S. Senators Sherrod Brown of Ohio, Ed Markey of Massachusetts, and Representatives Jan Schakowsky of Illinois, Judy Chu of California, Lacey Clay of Missouri, Gwen Moore of Wisconsin, and Jim McDermott of Washington all issued a statement of solidarity with the workers. They said they stand with the courageous Walmart workers demanding better wages and an end to illegal retaliation for union organizing. The lawmakers said Walmart has a responsibility to their workers and to the nation to respect workers and their rights. One of America's biggest electric power corporations locked out 150 Pennsylvania union workers just before the Thanksgiving holiday. Penelec, owned by First Energy, is demanding concessions from the workers who are members of the Utility Workers of America. The company wants to cut pensions and retiree health benefits. First Energy also wants concessions from 1,100 other UWUA workers at three other utilities it owns in West Virginia, Maryland, and Virginia. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032.
Our production team for tonight's newscast is Abani Ibbotson, Genevieve McDaniel, and Robin Ryan. The producers are Joe Meyer and me. Special thanks to Jimmy Tardy. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm John Rasmussen.
And I'm Ross Freeman Levin. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, here at the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with Abe Proctor and Joe Uris. At 9, on Alternative Radio, journalist and professor Rami Khoury speaks on the unfinished Arab revolutions. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary.
At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on Stage and Studio, join host D-May Roberts for conversation and a live concert with Christmas Revels executive director Debbie Garman and Vagabond Opera's Eric Stern and director Bruce Hostler. We'll hear tales and accordion music. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, Jim Riswell will be Ava Lake's guest. They'll talk about his latest show, Art for Oncologists.
Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support for this community radio station. If you are not a member, you can become one today by going to KBOO-FM and clicking on Donate Today.
We go now to a special report by KBOO reporter Jimmy Tardy. This Thursday, the Occupy Portland Elder Caucus will be screening Growthbusters, Hooked on Growth, a documentary concerning the process of sustainability. Here's the interview.
I'm speaking with Dave Gardner. He's the producer of the documentary Growthbusters, Hooked on Growth, How Do We Become a Sustainable Civilization? Thanks for joining me, Dave. We're going to be screening the film Thursday, December 5th at the Multnomah Friends Meeting House, which is at 4312 Southeast Stark. Everyone is invited. It's a free event, and they are not asking for RSVPs, but it is a medium-sized room, so they're hoping to pack it. So come down, and you'll get a chance to see a little bit different take on sustainability. Dave, I watched the film, and I guess about two-thirds of the way through the film is when it seemed to me that this sort of became a documentary about your realization of some of the underlying issues connected with sustainability.
Well, it certainly has been a journey. Making the film was a journey for me. I started out thinking I was going to make a documentary about population growth, mostly at the local level, because I was kind of perplexed by the fact that cities across North America are convinced that if they're not growing, they're dying. But it didn't take me long to discover that I was really trying to wrap my hands around a global issue, and it's not just population growth, but it's our obsession with economic growth as well.
So as you were confronting this issue, the film kind of takes through some of the video of you presenting your case before city councils, and there seemed to be a lot of resistance to what you were saying. The remarks that is in the film that some of the city councilors are making in response to your presentation to them are kind of biting.
You should have seen the earlier cut of the film. You didn't see the worst of it. But you know what happens is that this is a film that really fundamentally challenges everything that we all thought we knew about the way the world works. So it certainly can be threatening to people who are very happy and entrenched in the way the world worked, you know, in the last century. Kind of in a nutshell, the film calls attention to the fact that we've outgrown our planet. Size of our population and our economy have gotten so big that we're now injuring the ecosystems that we depend on. We've been on this 200-year binge, and a lot of good came from that, and people, you know, they cling to that. They want to keep on having the good life, but it turns out that, you know, we've allowed the definition of the good life to be hijacked, and so the system of this growth-obsessed system really isn't delivering the good life anymore.
One of the, I guess, highlights for me in the film was the professor. He was explaining about bacterial growth and how at a certain point the bacteria seem to have twice as much room as they need, but then within one generation they've filled their entire vessel.
Yeah, that's Al Bartlett, world-famous physicist who we just lost in September. He passed away, which was a tragic loss. But I was really glad that I had dedicated the documentary to Al Bartlett, and it was because this was a man who he was requested all over the world to deliver this famous lecture that he does about exponential growth. Al said that the greatest failing of the human race is our inability to comprehend the exponential growth, which is the amount of growth that you have this generation depends on how big the last generation was. So it's like compound interest. If you put your money away, you start saving for retirement when you're 20, the power of compounding, you know, you end up with a lot of money by the time you're 60 or 70 years old. And the same thing happens with population. And Al does this great demonstration that's been really popular in the film, where it really surprises everybody how things can look very comfortable and you are right on the edge of disaster. I don't know if I explained that as well as I should, but you should come and watch the film.
Absolutely. It really does very quickly and very graphically, easy to digest explanation of exponential growth. And that was the point that really, I guess, was a bit of an education for me, was the fact that, I guess, right before you run out of room, you don't realize that you're about to run out of room.
That's entirely true. And it's because with exponential growth, you end up with if you graph it, it ends up looking like a hockey stick laid horizontally on the ground. The growth seems pretty moderate for a long time, but then when it starts to take off, it really takes off. And that's exactly, of course, what happened with world population, where 6 billion of the 7 billion people on the planet were just added in the last 150 years out of 10,000 years of human civilization.
Exactly. And that point about the 10,000 years of human civilization that maybe escapes people, because we live in a culture and cultures develop over time. And given enough time, a culture will sort of approach something like a steady state as far as its sustainability. And humans have thousands and thousands of years of sustainable behavior because things were moving along at a slow enough growth rate that the planet was able to absorb it no problem. I guess the point is that cultures sort of validate the behaviors of the members of those cultures. And if that culture has a very long time span in order to validate itself, it doesn't really have any problem on a cultural level with making the statement that we need to expand our population and that people should have large families and that people should procreate with no restrictions. These type of notions are based on a world that doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, and I find it very curious that we've only been in this high growth mode for a couple of hundred years, and yet we've kind of reached the conclusion that that is the way we're supposed to live in the future. And it's only because of fossil fuels that we've really been able to have as much economic growth and population growth as we've had. And as you well know, as the supplies of oil begin to diminish, as it becomes ever and ever more dangerous and more expensive to get the last oil out of the planet, we're going to struggle greatly to feed the 7 or the or even the 11 billion people that the United Nations envisions may be living on the planet by the turn of the century. Without oil, we can't do it. So the future is not going to look like the past.
That's right. For good or for bad, oil does support the old cultural notions that we have about, like you're saying, how to live the good life. And it has sort of subsumed some of these practices that we used to engage in, which were, you know, really very productive practices when they were implemented with a large cache of cultural wisdom. So we're coming up on Thanksgiving, and we are all inescapably aware that Native indigenous populations in the Americas existed here for thousands of years, tens of thousands of years, and grew and lived sustainable lives. And something that I'd like to, there's a criteria that I like to look at what for me makes something sustainable, and that's the fact that when you look back, it doesn't leave many traces of itself. So the indigenous populations of North America, the traces that we have of them are actually very minimal, and that's because the techniques that they used and the items that they were using were essentially sustainable. But with oil, when we look back just at the last 150 years, we see obvious signs that we've been here. And we know when you add in uranium and all other chemicals that we're using, that these signals of us being here are going to persist for a very long time.
Yeah, you know, we've developed this really complex civilization, and then the complexity works against us, but also the numbers, too. You know, back when there were a few million people on the planet, or even 500 million people on the planet, you could get away with making a few mistakes and have some impact on the environment, and then you could just move away and let that valley or that watershed, drainage basin, whatever it might be, recover. You know, and it could be, you know, hundreds of years before you needed to return to that part of the world to once again harvest nature's bounty. But now we have over 7 billion people on the planet. So there's really no place that we can leave our accidents. Our accidents, our mistakes, our effluent. You know, the people on the west coast of the U.S., great example. You know, the air quality on the west coast of the U.S. is impacted by what's being burned in China, for God's sake. So the game has changed absolutely, completely, forever.
And we don't seem to have the cultural wisdom or practices to deal with the situation that we are facing right now. So again, I want to mention for our listeners, this coming Thursday at 7 o'clock at the Multnomah Friends Meeting House, which is at 4312 Southeast Stark. It's a showing of the documentary Growth Busters, Hooked on Growth, How Do We Become a Sustainable Civilization? It's a showing that's being facilitated by the Occupy Portland Elders Caucus. They're still hanging in there, folks. They haven't gone anywhere. And as a matter of fact, they continue to grow their network, their numbers, and their activities. And Dave, what do you hope is coming down the pipeline sooner, hopefully, rather than later, in regards to how we're going to re-envision the way that we deal with the world and become actually sustainable?
Well, I think the reason I made the film was to kind of set us on the first step, and that is to start taking away the power of the cultural reinforcement that we get today. Today, there's no shortage of messages that tell us that growth is the path to prosperity and that we can grow forever. But I think once people see Growth Busters hooked on growth, they will begin to recognize that propaganda when it is fed to them, and they'll say, oh, that's a lie, or at least that's spin, and there's some serious question about whether we really can do that. And that takes away the power and helps people to begin open their minds to exploring just different ways of organizing their lives and organizing their economies. And I think we're going to get back to a more localized, more in touch with nature system, and that will allow us to be more in touch with what really counts in life, which isn't material accumulation of wealth and possessions.
So I find it somewhat fitting that it is the Occupy Portland Elder Caucus that is trying to pursue and recapture some wisdom, some cultural wisdom that we can utilize and live by in order to, like you said, avoid some of the spin that we're given and some of these cultural assumptions that we live under that simply are not good long-term practices. So again, that's going to be this coming Thursday at 7 p.m. at the Multnomah Friends Meeting House. That's at 4312 Southeast Stark. I've been speaking with Dave Gardner. He's the producer of the documentary Growth Busters, Hooked on Growth, How Do We Become a Sustainable Civilization? And when you've been going through the process that you've been going through and your own wisdom about this issue has evolved, Dave, what's kind of been some of the things that have really sort of maybe taken you aback?
I think the biggest surprise for me was to discover at some point along the way that my mission in life wasn't to convince the world to stop growing the human project on the planet. What I discovered was that growth is coming to a stop. We're living through the end of economic growth and the beginning of the end of population growth. Mother Nature, the planet is pushing back and isn't going to allow us to continue on the path that we temporarily took for the last 200 years. So what I'm really hoping is that I can help people come to embrace